Well, everyone, welcome, and thank you for coming. I am very happy to present Professor Webb Keene from the University of Michigan. Professor Keene has received his PhD from the University of Chicago, so he's another Chicago person. And he was trained at Chicago in both linguistics and cultural anthropology. His committee advisors were Marshall Solomons and Michael Silverton, two key figures in the field, which he has now emerged in himself. He has taught at the University of Pennsylvania, and as I mentioned, is currently at the University of Michigan, where he serves as professor and director of graduate studies. Now, Professor Keene's key geographical interest is in Indonesia. That's where he spent a lot of time doing ethnographic research, and he's currently putting together a project on Indonesian journalism. Now, Professor Keene has numerous articles and book chapters, and he has two key books out. One is called Signs of Recognition, Powers and Hazards of Representation in Indonesian Society. And his second book, published most recently, is called Christian Moderns, Freedom and Fetish in the Mission Encounter. In fact, this is really, really cool, but I just mentioned that this book was the subject of a panel last year at the AAA, this last 2007 meeting. And I figured that, you know, if your book becomes the subject of a panel at some point, you kind of made it. Would that my book will do something like that one day. But in any case, he has also received numerous awards, and one that stands out is that he gave the Edvard Westermarck Memorial Lecture last fall in Helsinki. Now, his key interests are language and semiotics. As I said, he also does cultural anthropology, but he also, and I did not know this, he has also been engaged in archaeology most recently. Now, one of his formative experiences was working with Richard Berger, an Andean archaeologist, and doing some work in Peru, actually doing graphic illustrations.
Drawing thousands and thousands of pot shards.
Without getting any recognition for that, incidentally, which often happens. And most recently, he's been actually engaged with the Çatalhöyük project, a little project going on in the general direction of Ian Hodder in Turkey. So this is really neat, and the focus of his work here is looking at Neolithic religion. So today, Professor Keene is going to speak to the role of to the relationship of language and religion, and is presenting a talk that is entitled "Religion as Linguistic Practice." So please send a warm welcome to Professor Keene.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's lovely to sort of get into the time machine and travel forward about a month in time from the town where I live, which had 5 inches of snow last week. It's very nice to be here. This is what you're actually going to hear is a version of the Westermarck lecture, without the parts about Westermarck, which were actually a lot of fun to think about, but. Who now reads Edvard Westermarck? He's actually very interesting, but that's a story for another time. In the history of social and cultural anthropology, the category of religion has long stood for the general problem of apparently strange beliefs. Since the beginnings of European expansion, the encounter with the strangeness of other people's beliefs, from cannibalism to virgin birth, has been, say from Montaigne to Malinowski, has been an instigation to cross-cultural study. Indeed, the problem of strange beliefs was one motive, one might argue, for the very idea of culture in the anthropological sense. When anthropologists attempted to explain shamanism, witchcraft, or human sacrifice, they seemed to need an idea like culture. For strange beliefs might turn out to be not so strange if viewed in the context of a background constellation of meanings more or less tacitly accepted by those people who were then held to share that culture. In that context, beliefs should not only make sense, they should also be evidence of the very existence of the culture that sustains them. But then, we make that move, it appears that the category of religion begins to slip. For consider, if we define religion in terms of strange beliefs, and then we set out to explain why, when properly understood, those beliefs are not so strange, right? Once put in context, we seem to have explained away the very feature by which we were able to identify and isolate the category of religion in the first place. So what then remains of the category of religion? Is it in fact coherent across cases? This question is one version of anthropology's tension between particularist and comparative projects. It's a very deep tension that runs, I would argue, through anthropology right from the start. It's both part of the dynamism of anthropology and the impossibility of it. There are two things anthropologists have usually claimed they can do well. One is to expand our empirical range across contexts in order to counteract a natural propensity to provincialism. The second is to situate empirical findings within context, an ambition at least once talked about in terms of understanding the native point of view. The effort to do both at once seems to invite paradox, and most anthropologists have tended towards one or the other side. A glance at two recent discussions about religion, one within evolutionary cognitive anthropology, another within postcolonial critique, will illustrate the problem. One recent attempt to develop a universal theory of religion is given by cognitive anthropologists. I think next week you're going to hear the source. Pascal Boyer, for example, claims that out of all possible ideas about the supernatural, it turns out that only a relatively limited number actually appear on the ethnographic record. And many of these ideas seem to have been reinvented in unrelated societies. He explains this by asserting that although people may come up with any number of ideas about the supernatural, only some of them will be interesting and memorable enough to circulate from person to person and to be perpetuated over time. These will be the ideas that are based on certain cognitive templates, such as the category of person, that are violated, but only in limited ways. The idea here is that a god, for example, is not visible and not mortal, but is like a person in every other way, so you can draw inferences on the basis of that. It allows people to draw inferences that are not explicit in anything that they have been taught about their supernatural ideas. So, for example, you go to Greek mythology and you find that Zeus is invisible and has enormous powers, but Hera can still trick him, right? Can still fool him. So he has some of the same perceptual limitations that we have. Now, I find two aspects of this theory useful. First, Boyer wisely avoids the pitfall of most universal theories of religion and does not claim that religion has any one purpose overall. Second, by giving an important place to inferences, the explanation frees up cultural phenomena from an excessive dependence on something like rote transmission from generation to generation. In this one respect, at least, Boyer is in accord with other tendencies in cultural anthropology. For if there is anything anthropologists have come to stress in recent years, it is that cultures are creative projects as much as they are conservative traditions. Indeed, one of the more useful ways to think of culture, perhaps, is not in terms of sharing or persistence, but rather in terms of a capacity for innovation, that what really distinguishes the whole notion of culture in the anthropological sense is a human capacity to invent worlds, not simply to cling to them or to share them with other people. So let's take the example of possible inferences in a society in which the people themselves tend to think of themselves as highly conservative, that this is their own self-image. And these are the people on the eastern Indonesian island of Sumba, where I've done a great deal of research. The people of Sumba perform rituals directed towards ancestral spirits, or certainly when I started my fieldwork there 20 years ago, the majority of Sumbanese still did this. The situation is fast changing. Most Sumbanese, including Christians, accept that those rituals were transmitted without any subsequent addition from the time of the earliest ancestors. So they have a highly conservative view of themselves. We do things the way they've always been done. But most Sumbanese have only the dimmest ideas about those ancestral spirits, where they are located, what they're up to when you're not making offerings to them, how they actually carry out acts like making it rain are simply not of much interest to anyone. But following Boyer's reasoning, we might say that because ancestor spirits are quasi-persons, it is possible to speculate beyond what tradition tells you. And every once in a while, someone will do this. And someone like the man, who, a very close friend of mine, named, whom I'll call here, Umpahainu, will do this. Umpahainu was very happy to stay up all night with me. I mean, he really was, you know, the perfect anthropologist native. He's just, you know, what interested me interested him. And he was very happy to stay up all night with me, huddled around the hearth, pursuing the most arcane philosophical questions, while his family was sort of snickered at us for the ludicrousness of our activity and its worthlessness, basic worthlessness. But he's very happy to stay up all night this way. And speculations like Umpahainu's might just eventually add something new to the cultural materials available to Sumerese more widely. That is to say, there's nothing to prevent these speculations of his from at least some of them, from taking off in some respects. And there's a great deal of, there are all sorts of constraints on that and all sorts of conditions for the possibility, which we won't go into here. But the point is that the possibility of adding something new to these cultural materials is provided by the possibility of drawing inferences from the little that you already know on the basis of the resemblance of the rest to your basic intuitions about the way the world is. Nothing about ritual per se rules out this innovative possibility. There are, however, I think, severe limitations to the usefulness of this sort of cognitive approach to religion. Any analysis of cultural phenomena, including religions, I believe, or at least in the approach that I have favored, should attempt, indeed must attempt, to deal with their public character, with their publicness. It should also attempt to deal with their historical character, the fact that every cultural phenomenon of which we are aware is located in historical time and is in a state of transformation, that has a past and it has a future. Cognitive approaches tend to stress universal mental experiences, at least the sort favored by Pascal Boyer. Suppose one day I'm strolling along and suddenly I encounter the Virgin Mary. Or one night I dream that I've been granted powers by a jaguar spirit. Or right now, all of a sudden, I start speaking fluently in a voice in a language that are not my own. And certainly people have such experiences. They're well recorded. And we may even grant that each involves, in fact, depends upon, requires certain identifiable cultural phenomena. But what makes these respectively a vision, a prophetic experience, or a case of spirit possession, rather than, say, a fantasy, a dream, a psychotic episode, the effects of drugs, or a sudden hit? Excuse me, the effect of a sudden head injury. Well, at least one aspect is that they are instances of categories that are recognizable to other people. It is not an automatic business that this happens. It is not an automatic business that they will be so recognized. For even in places where shamanism or spirit possession are well accepted, relatively frequent occurrences, in any given instance, local communities have to decide whether they now have a case of possession or, say, madness or fraud or error. And there's some wonderful case studies that have shown that in villages which sustain shamanistic careers, there are cases of failed shamanistic careers where people, it turns out that on examination, villagers decide, well, in fact, no. This person's not a shaman after all. She's just, she's a fraud or... she's actually just crazy. Ethnographers who have seen this decision-making progress tell that it's not at all a foregone conclusion how the decisions will go. The socially relevant outcome results from the irreducible conjunction of a potentially open-ended set of things beyond cognitive basics. And these include any number of things such as micropolitics, recent precedents, you know, what happened last year, kinship ties, or what concepts happen to be currently circulating in public? What are the available, you know, what TV shows happen to be, people happen to be watching? And these outcomes become the context within which subsequent actions and decisions are made. The very materiality of this context, which makes actions and ideas public, has a direct bearing on morality, as I will argue below, although I think I may have cut that argument out, but we'll see. The process of getting this down to 50 minutes. in my forthcoming multi-volume treatise. Okay, even unique cases such as, say, the Star over Bethlehem, where Saul's conversion on the road to Damascus must become recognizable as instances of something that is potentially repeatable, even if in only the discursive form of reports. I mean, there's only one Star over Bethlehem, but you know it's a star, you know it's a sign, and once you tell the story can be told and people will know what you're talking about. So it's, if only in the discursive form of report it's repeatable, if they are to count as religious. Or more generally, if they are to have a potential for social existence. In order to be recognizable as instances of something knowable, they must take semiotic form. They must, that is, have some material manifestation that makes them available to, interpretable by, and in most cases replicable by other people. Bodily actions, speech, treatment of objects, and so forth. This is not simply an issue for remarkable events or the experiences of virtuosi. A similar point holds for spontaneous and commonplace cognitive phenomena, such as a child's invisible friends. It's the sort of thing that Boyer points to. Well, children have invisible friends, right? But that doesn't make them, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's a foundation of religions without all these other public contextualizing circumstances. So the point holds for such things as children's invisible friends or magical thinking. Step on a crack or break my mother's back, and so forth. I mean, the Victorian English armchair anthropologists love to look at these things and tell us that this is where religion must come from. For it is apparent that what circulate are not ideas or experiences. We're not telepathic beings. What circulate are semiotic forms. I don't have access to your ideas except insofar as they are mediated by signs such as words, movements. Signs have forms, they have material properties. They're also repeatable. But there's nothing to guarantee that they will produce identical interpretations or experiences across time or between persons. As semiotic forms, they are public entities. That is, they're available as objects for the senses and are not confined to inner or subjective experience. As such, they have distinctive temporal dimensions. Because they are repeatable, they have the potential to persist over time and across social context. One result is that they can enter into individual and social projects. Semiotic forms accumulate new features over time, contributed by different people with different projects in different contexts. The speculations of Ubuhayu start from what in his youth he saw and heard the old men do when they were communicating with the spirits. One of the things they do is make offerings of metal. Now, a century ago, these were small pieces of metal. As money, however, entered into the Sumbanese economy in the mid-20th century, it became common to use a coin for this purpose. It was one of the more readily available sources of metal. But if you don't have a coin, nowadays, as of the 1990s, you could substitute paper money for it. Coin, paper money, there's still money. Notice here the quiet innovation. The shifting of the categorical identity of the offering from its metallic properties, which we know from the ethnographic context is the most likely, across the Malay world, metal has boundary-protecting characters and rituals and has, as far back as we have recorded evidence. So they have a quiet innovation, shifting the categorical identity of the offering from its metallic properties to its association with value. By the time you can substitute paper money for a coin, you're focusing no longer on the fact of being metal, but on the fact of containing value. Thus, the relative salience of coexisting properties of the offering has been altered, but not the public identity of the offering itself. More generally, the work people put into cultural phenomena draws not just on ideas, but on the properties of the semiotic forms. These properties characteristically form clusters with those of other phenomena. Rituals develop multiple parts. Scriptures acquire liturgies. Gods acquire apotheoses. Sacrifices acquire temples. Temples acquire temporal keepers. Thus, they are historical in character. However much any particular component of the phenomenon may rest on some universal features of human minds, as indeed they must, the assemblage is the outcome of contingent factors of historical context. Now, this argument threatens to lead us back to the hyper-particularism of local knowledge, which is, you know, if I've just portrayed the universalistic Silas, now I want to argue against the particularistic Charybdis. Consider an alternative, markedly historicist approach to the anthropology of religion. Talal Asad has criticized efforts to define religion as a trans-historical and trans-cultural phenomenon in the first place. And he's done so on a number of reasons, most of which I'm not going to go into here because they're not germane to my argument. But according to Asad, with the first efforts to produce a universal definition of religion in the 17th century, the emphasis on beliefs, he writes, meant that henceforth religion could be conceived as a set of propositions to which believers gave assent. Now, Asad observes that universalizing definitions of religion have tended to privilege belief as a cognitive and ultimately private or subjective phenomenon. Many familiar objections and alternatives have been posed against this privileging of belief. I'm certainly not the first, nor is Asad the first to raise this question. That Rodney Needham raised similar problems a generation earlier. Asad raises two challenges in particular. The first is that the emphasis on belief had tended to fold into a further claim that these beliefs concerned, that the beliefs that we identify as religious concerned ultimate meanings. What is the purpose of life? What happens after death? How did it all begin? What are the foundations of morality and so forth? But by those terms, many of the things people do, including Umuhaingu's ancestral rituals, what we might want to count as religious, are simply ruled out of court. Somebody's never asked those questions, except possibly what happens after death. The apparently neutral description turns out on examination to be normative, and a great deal of the politics of Asad's argument on this rests on the political implications of that normativity. For evangelists in some nation states, like contemporary Indonesia, people who lack religion under such definitions require conversion. The material focus of their rituals seems to militate against the true morality of an immaterial conscience. Any definition of religion that privileges particular subjective experiences or beliefs, I argue, risks being circular. To avoid this, the category of religion must be capable of including not just the ardently faithful, but the bored schoolboy who has memorized a credo which he recites by rote when summoned to do so. The nun standing over him with a ruler about to rap his knuckles if he doesn't. To say that the latter is not really religious is to make the definition of religion as a matter of genuine, wholehearted faith, self-confirming, circular. I would argue that we need that bored schoolboy and his rote recitations. I would suggest that, for one thing, this is because belief ontogenically follows in practice. The child learns a prayer, or listens to scripture in a foreign language like Latin or Arabic, or sees her grandmother go into trance, or helps the priest by holding a sacrificial chicken. She may develop beliefs as a result, but they depend on the prior existence of the material practice. This does not mean that beliefs are determined by those practices, far from it. Quite the contrary, as the Boyd school, indeed the Boyd schoolboy should tell us this. The fact that the fact that the bored schoolboy can recite the credo just like that tells nothing about his inner states. But even the most spiritualized of scriptural religions teach doctrines through concrete activities, such as catechisms, sermons, scripture reading, and exegesis. Even Saul's conversion experience on the road to Damascus had to become communicable in some form that made it recognizable to others. Many religious traditions have little interest in either individual belief or public statements of doctrine. Some of these, for example, may accept differences of interpretation as long as the practices themselves remain consistent. What is of recurrent significance to them is the question, what can or must we do? A moral question about material practice. Moreover, even religions that do stress belief may still object to the subordination of material practices to inner states. The very existence of a practice may be the basis for moral judgment and semiotic form, a component of its morality. I just packed a whole argument in there that I don't think I'm going to have time to unpack. As Sabah Mahmoud has argued, the Muslim veil is not merely an expression of piety. In some circumstances, it is consubstantial with it. Moral agents are constituted in an intersubjective field. Another argument that I'm just going to have to toss out there. It is as objective beings with bodies, words, actions that have form and substance. It is in that materiality that they enter into the public world of moral judgments of one another. Any spiritualizing or transcendentalizing effort to separate the soul or conscience from the semiotic form by which they are judged can only be at the best an extrapolation from the to the unreachable end of a trajectory that always touches ground in words, bodies, or other things. This, I think, is one reason why materiality has been historically such a fraught domain for religious reformers. However much a ritual gesture, prayer, or shrine may seem to point beyond itself, its objective form has all the anxiety-producing persistence of an irresolvable paradox. See Christian Moderns for more on that. Now, can we define religion in a way, then, that takes seriously the perspectives I've just offered you, the universalizing and the particularistic arguments? Can we define religion in a way that takes seriously the perspective of its practitioners, without claiming a sort of a divine omnipotence of the objectivistic point of view from nowhere, and still guide research across contexts without, that is to say, still make comparison possible? Can we do so in a way that respects the historicity of the phenomenon without returning to full-fledged particularism? Well, I'm looking for that way, and what I want to do with the rest of the talk today is to point in that direction, without actually arriving in any kind of promised land. I'll focus here on linguistic activity, which, although selective, is not, I think, arbitrary. For one thing, religions very often focus on language as a source of difficulty, which, again, I'm going to have to gesture at. Linguistic practices, of course, are especially interesting in the context of questions of belief because they so often seem to point us in the direction of thoughts. But this is a conclusion about which I think we should be very cautious. Instead, an examination of religious language may be useful as a guide to how we understand religious practices more generally. My central argument for the possibility of comparison is that the linguistic features of ritual speech typically impose some markedness relative to other ways of speaking, some sense of being unusual. They do so in a way that seems to promise to encounter or to be a response to some kind of difficulty, to require effort. Religious language may, for example, demand extra control or aim to release language from control, become more spontaneous, make it more elaborate, or to simplify it. They are not marked, however, against some universal norms, but against local ideologies of language, assumptions locally about the relation between language and reality and its speakers. Is the prototypical speech act referring to objects and making a predication about them? Or is it a promise between two individuals? Or is it a command between two hierarchical statuses? Is language a set of arbitrary signs established by social convention? Or is it a divine emanation expressing the true, if hidden, essence of the world? How you use words and what will count as the relatively marked or unmarked uses of words will depend in part on such assumptions. Now, this definition, I think, can only be a starting point, but it aims to satisfy the two opposed demands on the anthropologist. One, to take practitioners' own perceptions as our guide. Two, without foreclosing the possibility of comparison. This approach presupposes that people have some intuitions or language ideology about distinctions of markedness among different linguistic forms and practices. Beliefs, then, can be understood as parasitic on activities rather than as activities as expressing or as evidence for prior beliefs. By emphasizing this, I think we can go beyond imputing the experiential effects of ritual to convention or to belief. Rather, we can ask how those experiential effects derive from ritual forms as they unfold in real time. I argue in my first book, Signs of Great Condition, that part of the efficacy of Sumini's rituals is the way in which, as they play out over real time, they have these decontextualizing and depersonalizing effects, which took a long time to demonstrate, but that's the gist. Forms that decontextualize discourse help create a perception that certain chunks of speech are self-contained belong together, could be reproduced in different contexts. We're producing what we call a decentering of discourse. The words that have been decentered in this way will seem to come from a source beyond the present situation in which they're being spoken and heard. They may even produce the effect on the part of the effect that speakers themselves feel that they have little volition in producing their own speech. One may be speaking as the ancestors did, or as the spirit who possesses you dictates, or as it has been written scripturally. Effects of linguistic form are likely to seem especially persuasive and realistic because they are not derived from explicit doctrines, which one might doubt or deny, but which seem to come directly from experience. The decentering of discourse is one moment in a larger set of dialectical processes that also include the centering or recontextualizing of discourse, processes which stress the relatively objective and subjective experiences of language, respectively, such as the spirit, the experience of inner speech. It's a garbled sentence. The point here is that as decontextualized speech gets recontextualized, it may produce a greater emphasis or may lead to a greater emphasis on inner speech and speaker's intentionality. Since the experience of linguistic, whereas the decontextualization produces the sense that it diminishes the sense of volition on the part of the speaker, and reinforces the sense that the real agent is someone else. The real agent is a divine source, for example. Since the experience of linguistic form is relatively independent of any particular intentions of or interpretations by language users, people's responses to that experience will be historically variable. Suspicions of language in some religious traditions, such as Quakerism, which rejects liturgy, or Massowe Apostolics in Africa, who reject scripture altogether, focus on the very same linguistic and pragmatic properties that other traditions may seek to exploit. To the extent that ritual practices respond to or contribute to the perception of an ontological gap contrary to the assumptions of ordinary interactions, I can't see you, I can't hear you, I'm not even sure if you're there, do you read me, do you hear me, that they may be prone to draw on the decentering and recentering possibilities of contextualization processes. For religions of the book, scriptural religions, the very existence of a written scripture is often taken as evidence for claims to an authority that transcends any particular context. But the same decontextualizing objectivity may become the target of reformers and critics who seek more direct access to divinity, such as the Quakers. The very materiality of the text, the displacement of agency that it provokes, focus the moral anxieties that demand reform. Hence, the Protestant Reformation. To put it briefly, differences in linguistic form can serve under socially specified conditions as evidence for differences in responsibility, for what claims the words make, or what actions they carry out. One of the stakes in the precise distinction between author and animator is the degree of agency, authority, and responsibility a performer is willing or permitted to assume. In the United States, evangelical Protestants often describe their conversion as a call to witness, to testify, to preach to others. Often this does not involve any particular change in belief, if we mean the doctrines to which they subscribe. So those who are born again often believe the same doctrines that they believed before they were born again. But what is different? In such cases, full conversion consists in becoming enabled to speak scriptural language with a new kind of authority, to allow the Holy Spirit to take over, to essentially divest oneself of one form of agency and replace it with another. This is an instance of the broader point that one widespread effect of religious language is the creation or extension of agents and forms of agency beyond what is commonly available in an unmarked interaction. Many of the effects of religious language can be better understood, I think, as expanding the presumptive speaker above the level of the individual. But the reverse also occurs, distinguishing among different voices below that level, emanating from a single body. Spirit possession, glossolalia, some preaching styles involve both a deity and a human being using the same body, speaking in different voices. Conversely, reformist movements may place a greater emphasis on cultivating the sincere intentionality and transparency of the speaker intentionality on the part of the possessor of that body, as in the demand that his prayer be spontaneous. The emphasis on sincere intentions usually manifests language ideology. It privileges individual interiority and places great moral weight on distinguishing interior state from exterior words. The encounter between this ideology and actual linguistic activities can have powerful consequences. For example, the language ideology of some evangelicals assumes that utterances are always the expression of conscious individual intentions under normal conditions. Therefore, when under stress people utter words they didn't intend, slips of the tongue or more, the only possible conclusion one can draw is that we see here the hand of divine agency. This is a condition by the ideological predisposition to see language as being entirely intention-driven. Not the case, for example, among Sundanese. It mediates the practices that produce experiences of agency that are expanded, displaced, distributed, or otherwise different from, but clearly related to, what are otherwise available. Now, I want to repeat here a little bit of an argument that I made in early part of Christian Moderns, just to show where this fits in. This has to do with creeds, which are a larger part of a set of genres, including sermons, scripture reading, and some kinds of prayer, that recontextualize certain texts in liturgical and everyday practice. The creed normally looks like a series of propositions about the world, but they're peculiar in certain respects. First, usually they're formulaic, condensing complex arguments about doctrine into a readily learned and reproducible form. Moreover, the propositions are attached to a performative of assent. The creed states an objective claim. It is the case that Jesus is the Son of God. As such, it appears to be merely a proposition. But it has performative force. The Nicene Creed begins, "We believe." It asserts the speaker's alignment with the claims. Jesus is the Son of God, is true about the world, and I hold that it is true. Moreover, it publicly reports this alignment. Jesus is the Son of God, is true about the world, and I hold that it is true, and I hereby state so to the rest of you. I take public responsibility for the match between my words and the world itself. The creed takes then the publicly circulating form of an assertion. It represents the speaker as taking responsibility for her own thoughts. To be sure, the schoolboy may memorize the creed as mere rote. But the persistent recurrence of religious reform movements suggests that the semiotic form of the creed entails a normative tilt toward taking responsibility for those words, for making them one's own. Since they are supposed to be transparent to one's inner thoughts, this stance towards one's own words is a model for both sincerity and responsibility. The practice of speaking a creed helps convey a norm of being able to objectify thoughts as words, and by avowing them in this way, taking responsibility, not just for one's words, but for one's very thoughts, so there's kind of an agency over one's inner life. It thus encourages a distinction between the abstraction of thought and the materiality of its expression, mediated by a moral norm of sincerity in which the immaterial thought is, in which the material expression is held to be in some sense parasitic on the immaterial thought. The centrality of creeds to the conventional understanding of religion in Western society, I would argue, reinforces the assumption that religions are above all about ideas, and that their materializations are merely parasitic on those ideas or expressions of those ideas, and, in the case of many reform movements, are a source of moral anxiety. And this is the anxiety that underlies everything from Quakerism to the Massalia Apostolics. In the creed, we see one way in which religion bears a morality. Not all moral actions can be properly called religious. This is true in many cases for gifts, hospitalities, certain forms of kinship. But if by religion we mean a certain way of marking actions and evoking special kinds of agents, this markedness may bring the moral character of agency into focus. Through objectifications, religious practices work on the doxic but taken for granted and bring aspects of it out of the penumbra of habit into the bright center of attention. So there's been a strong divide between those who take history seriously and find that it makes comparison impossible, and those whose comparative projects lead them to treat the historicity of their object as inessential, as mere noise. So Tal al-Assad, we may say, stands for those who take history seriously and find that it undermines the possibility of comparison. Pascal Boyer stands for those for whom the historicity of their object is simply insignificant. The matter has no interest. Certain styles of critical postmodernist thought step on one side, resurgent positivism on the other. I suggested that both positions at the extreme are untenable. In fact, part of the interest of anthropology, it seems to me, lies precisely in the extraordinarily almost paradoxical difficulty of grappling with bringing these together. By focusing on semiotic forms, we may start to develop an alternative to the particulars and the universalizing extremes. Innovators like Ubuhaino tend to respond to the forms, the prayers, the procedures, the offerings that experience has made available to them. That is, practices are objects within experience to which people may respond. They can thus become sources of new intuitions, new habits, new concepts. Moral judgments start with these objects of experience, even if they point to something that lies beyond experience, such as virtue, the soul, the good, the God. Much of the history of scriptural religions consists of struggles between correct dogma and practical deviation, between purification and accretion. The recurrent theme in these struggles is the tension between abstract and material entities in semiotic form, the undescribable God of the mystic or the negative theologian, the physicality of the amulet, high doctrine, rituals, sounds, and smells. The Protestant Reformation is defined in part by that moment when the very same Roman Catholic liturgy that could have been experienced in terms of divine immanence becomes instead, in Martin Luther's words, quote, so much babbling and bellowing. He's hearing the same thing that Catholics had heard for centuries before. Now it's babbling and bellowing. To the extent the semiotic form is an unavoidable component of any cultural phenomenon, including those held to lie beyond representation, and involves an irreducibly public dimension, that reformist purifications cannot fully and permanently establish themselves within religious traditions. If religions continually produce material forms, those forms can never be reduced only to the status of evidence for something else, such as beliefs. As material forms, they remain objects of experience with a certain degree of autonomy. As objects, they persist across contexts. They persist beyond any particular intentions and particular projects. To these objects, people may respond in new ways, as Martin Luther did to the Catholic liturgy. To the extent these responses become materialized in altered or new semiotic forms, those responses build on and are additive to the responses of other people in other contexts. These materializations bear the marks of their temporality. Let me close by observing a few things that follow from the relative autonomy of the semiotic forms from particular intentions and interpretations. In the first place, forms do not only permit new inferences, but as objects that endure across time, they can, in principle, acquire features unrelated to the intentions of previous users. This is in part because, as material forms, they are prone to enter into new contexts. But it is also the result of accumulation, as I suggested before. The history of any set of cultural practices is a matter of accretion and of stripping away. To revelation is added commentary. Liturgies produce architectures. Both require officers. Oral testimony comes to be inscribed. Written texts that result can be kissed, shrouded, worn about the neck, rendered into ashes to be swallowed, read for their literary beauty. Offerings expect altars. Altars support images. Images enter art markets. Art objects develop aura. Rituals provoke anti-ritualist purifiers. Religions develop heterodox rites. The very materiality of these things gives them an irreducibly historical character. Two important consequences follow. First, in their materiality, religious practices properly serve as evidence for something immaterial, such as belief, only under particular circumstances, under the guidance of particular semiotic ideologies. Second, the move from intention to object is not a one-way street. materialized religion is not simply a priori on survival, the fossilized trace of some agent's purpose is now lost. In any given instance, it is also part of a world that is giving rise to new agents and new purposes. Material forms are raw materials available for new exploitations. They are potential provocations. And here's where materiality can become a moral problem. First, some moral systems seem to stress the empirical character of right actions by insisting on procedural correctness. For example, religious purifiers who object to such systems typically focus their objections not just on their content, but on the very fact of their materiality. Semiotic form can be the very sign of the fact of that materiality itself. For example, religious reformers commonly argue that the problem with ritual is the materiality of the practice, is that the materiality of the practice displaces attention from the proper locus of moral judgment. This is sort of say within the Protestant tradition, or sort of say certain strands of Buddhism and so forth. It displaces attention from the proper locus of moral judgment, the conscience or the intention of the actor. Second, material forms can never be fully stabilized into material states. Therefore, they give rise to uncertainty and suspicion. One can never know for sure what inferences to draw from material form, including words. This inherent gap between material form and what it can appear to be materializing may, in certain historical contexts, make the very fact of materiality itself a prime locus for moral attention. Or at least, materiality can become the domain in which moral struggles are carried out. And third, since material forms are, by their very nature, highly particular and variable, in contrast to the abstract formulations of moral universal, they can seem to manifest the problem of moral relativism. Different practices, different moralities. Anti-ritualism of reformers worries about the relative autonomy of material practices from the particular intentions, interstates, moral intuitions whose primacy it assumes. In its more secular forms, anti-ritualism draws further impetus from what I have called the moral narrative of modernity in Christian modernism. This sees the elimination of ritual and its deities as part of a historical trajectory by which humans come to be emancipated through the realization of their own true agency. What such attacks on materiality tend to overlook is that acting subjects, such as people and deities, are situated in a public world only by virtue of their materialization and practices. It is, in the first instance, in their objective form that subjects become available for judgments by others. Indeed, one might argue that it is only by virtue of taking material form as objects for others that subjects can know themselves, at least in ways that are socially recognizable. In short, to the extent that moral judgments and disagreements focus on what people actually do, they depend on people's experiences of one another. Again, we are not mind readers. We don't engage in telepathy. For both these reasons, objectification is a necessary condition for moral agency. At the same time, the materiality of practices makes them relatively independent of particular agents whose purposes they always exceed. By virtue of the very, and this is true even of the words I might speak to you, which you may hear in some way I had not intended, which I cannot control. Sad to say. this is the pedagogic tragedy, right?
No, I know exactly.
I know exactly. Right. You can't be wrong. At the same time, the material, by virtue of the very materiality of any given practice, then there is always something more that could be made of it. The result we now know is a truism: social facts are irrevocably vulnerable to history. But this history, this sociality, and the materiality that produces them must not be evaded if we are to understand how humans really live with one another.